if the foam is unstable, meaning it has stresses inside it that make it want to shrink. If you slit it, it'll pop open and make a loud bang like a rifle going off. And, you know, that's a dimensional stability problem.
This is the one and only, the original podcast where you can find yours and your business's true value. You're listening to Our Value,
brought to you by America's Insulation Source, IDI Distributors.
You want to hear from the best contractors, suppliers, and consultants that dedicate themselves to more than just survival in the business world?
Industry professionals that are dedicated to excellence in every aspect of their business?
Our Value has them all here to share that same motivation and knowledge with you. Tune in and grow a more successful, profitable, educated, and recognized business. Listen to the Our Value podcast to become the industry leader in your market. Find your value with Our Value.
Welcome to all of you listening to the Our Value podcast. Today we have got a good one. I am sure you have heard of projects that did not go as planned, and I'm sure you guys have seen things online. You know, without going too deep into it, there's organizations on Facebook, there's places online you can see it, but sometimes spray foam jobs don't get done correctly. And so today we are talking with Henri Fennell. Now, Henri Fennell, he has been around this industry for quite a while. In fact, back in 1971, when he was becoming an architect or going to school to become an architect, was his first time he sprayed foam at one of the school projects. Then he started in the field in 1978. He opened a company called Foam Tech between 1981 and 82. He started doing building diagnostics in 1982. So when we talk about using an infrared camera and going out and pressurizing buildings or depressurizing buildings and looking for issues, he's been doing that for quite a while. But now, after spraying the Big Dig in Boston, the Guggenheim Museum, and many other things, he is now spending the last part of his career analyzing foam problems and writing remediation protocols and programs for that. Henri, thank you so much for joining us on the podcast today.
My pleasure, Ken.
What really is the most common call or problem you seem to get called on?
I think there are two. One is shrinkage, where the symptoms of that would be foam cracking or delaminating, and an odor or indoor air quality problem. Sometimes it's a smell. Sometimes it's a problem that the owner has with a respiratory issue or some kind of physical symptom.
Okay. So in your estimation, even when you're not getting a call, what do you see as the most common cause of problems on a spray foam project?
Problems for the owner or problems for the installer?
Well, if you're not getting a call, then we're not really sure. But, you know, when you go out and see projects, what usually, even if it's not something that caused a big ruckus, let's say, what do you see as the most common cause of problems with a spray foam project?
Well, first of all, I'd like to say the number of projects I see is a very small percentage of what's happening out there. You know, most of the projects go well, and I just don't want talking about foam problems to make it sound like that's, you know, they all have problems, because that's not the case. But I would say that the most likely or the biggest issue I see is not really following the manufacturer's instructions to the letter, not verifying that they're meeting the manufacturer's parameters for processing the foam or for installing it.
I'm glad you said that, because, okay, so when we look at most foam projects, they are tremendous. There are so many good projects out there, but there's also, whether it's carpentry or, you know, building a swimming pool, there are some people that don't pay attention, or they're not putting as much care into the installation. Now, when you say not following the manufacturer's instructions, are we talking how they handle and store the product, or are we talking about processing temperatures, or can you build on that a little bit?
The first thing I would say is always safety. You know, the installer needs to tell the client their house is going to be much tighter and what they have to do to you know, prepare for that or to address that. Combustion appliance zone safety is a key issue. The installers need to provide the owners with documentation that helps them to be prepared, like an SDS sheet and, you know, that kind of information. But the most common cause of a problem, I think, is the processing part of the application. And that means that chemicals have to be the right temperature, the portioner has to be on ratio, the, you know, they have to do their test shot in a way that they can actually see the whether the foam is of good quality. If you read the SPFA ACC documents on how to properly process the foam, it says do a test shot and make sure the foam is of good quality. And they don't tell you how to do a test shot. And I think the test shot is a critical step in the processing, or the last step where you get to verify the quality in the processing step. Everything after the gun is installation. Everything before the gun is processing.
When you say understanding how to properly do a test shot, how would you say you properly do a test shot?
I don't mean a smiley face on the plastic that's covering the windows, which is what I see most often. I mean doing what I call a surfboard strip test on plastic on the floor at the thickness that they intend to, you know, spray. In other words, the maximum lift thickness that the manufacturer recommends, and spraying that strip not with a back and forth motion, but with a straight shot so that the foam is... You can see that it if it's mixed or not without mixing it with the movement of the gun. So if you spray a 6 foot long strip on plastic, that's if it's a 4 inch system, 4 inches thick, and then let that set up, and then you cut that in half and look at the cell structure. First, as soon as it sets up, you flip it over and look at the bottom. You should see a uniform color from end to end. And that rules out lead and lag. And then when you cut it in half and slice it open, you can see if the cell structure is normal, cell sizes are uniform. You can smell it at that point. So that's the way I recommend or require the guys to do it if I'm overseeing a new installation.
Now, you brought up lead and lag. You want to define those two terms?
Sure. Lead and lag means you're spraying two chemicals and you want them to come out equally A and B as you spray. But if you have a restriction on one side or the other, you'll get one chemical, then you'll get both, and then you'll get the other chemical at the end. So that's the lead and the lag. That would tell you that you have a restriction in the system.
And you also mentioned material handling. And obviously we know that, you know, we're coming up on winter. This gets done at every temperature known to man. I've sent drums down to Yuma, Arizona, and had them look like torpedoes coming off the semi. So when you talk about material handling, how much has material handling been a factor on the projects you've had to go out to where you find that they're not getting properly processed foam?
The manufacturer tells you what temperature to store the material. And when you receive a truckload of drums or totes, you want to measure the temperature of them. Well, first of all, on your shipping papers, you want to say protect from freezing. And then when they bring the chemicals to the loading dock, you want to measure the temperature and make sure they're not frozen or below the temperature that the manufacturer says this is a safe temperature for shipping and handling. Then you want to store the chemicals above the lowest temperature or below the highest temperature. Remember that all of the temperatures for processing and for storage and preconditioning have upper limits too. So northern climates, you don't want them to be frozen. Southern climates, you don't want them to be so high that you boil out the blowing agent and blow up the drums as you were talking about. Then preconditioning is another temperature that not all manufacturers provide that number. They assume, you can assume, I guess, that it's the storage temperature, but Preconditioning is generally a higher temperature than storage.
So, Henri, one of the things you brought up was really the temperature of the materials or material handling. Can you elaborate on that?
Yeah, you need to get chemicals that aren't damaged by being frozen during shipping. Then you need to store them within the range that the manufacturer specifies for storage. And when you go to the job site, you need to take the chemicals close to what the preconditioning temperature is that's required, assuming you can heat them in your rig. And that means platform heaters, or in some case, some manufacturers allow recirculation, but most for closed cell. So you need to get the chemicals up to the temperature that the manufacturer reports for the specific gravity of the chemicals. So they'll say 72 or 70, and that means you have to have the chemicals preconditioned to that temperature in order for the proportioner to give you one-to-one in the volumes at the right temperature, which means at the right viscosity and specific gravity.
So actually, I can be off ratio just by being off temperature.
Correct. And that is the most common problem.
That's your most common?
The most common for off ratio. Most common cause of off ratio foam.
Is the wrong...
Is cold supply chemical temperatures.
Wow. Could I also be off by having too hot of supplied chemicals?
Yes. If you're in a southern climate, absolutely.
Wow.
Or you can... The other thing I've seen is you get to the job site on 110 degree day in the summer and you have winter blend on in the rig.
That could be scary.
Because now you have foam that is catalyzed at a level that's required for cold weather or colder weather that's being used on a very hot day on a very, very hot substrate.
Okay. So then what has typically been your solution that you've used to keep these things from happening? You mentioned platform heaters. You know, I'm sure you've had drums show up in every condition known to man. What was your practice?
Well, my practice was I would tell them before the job, and this is for new installs, I would tell them before the job that they had to show up with the chemicals preconditioned. Otherwise, they wouldn't be able to start until the chemicals were up to temperature. In other words, you'll have to go home or you'll have to sit here and wait until the drums get up to temperature.
So if I've got a drum, I know you've done this a long time. If I've got a drum that's 20 degrees too cold, how long is it going to take to get that drum up those 20 degrees if I'm just using, say, a platform heater or a blanket?
Well, if it's in a hot room, I know the number is about 1 degree per hour, but that's at a hot room that's, say, 90. If you're on a platform heater, I don't know that number, but it's going to take hours, not minutes. And if you can recirculate, it's still going to take hours because you can't recirculate at too high a temperature or you'll boil out the blowing agent on the B side.
Ooh, and that could be expensive. So,
well, you're way down and and then the ratio again will be off because the blowing agent is part of the one-to-one chemistry.
When you go to a project, then, you know, say you get a phone call. When you go to a project, how do you inspect it? Like when you get a phone call, what's your normal...
And after the fact problem project?
Yes.
Okay. Well, first of all, I look for the insulation certificate that's supposed to be at or on the electric panel. That's a code requirement. Then I find out what the brand is, how thick they were supposed to spray it, what the R value per inch is, etc. So that's the first step. That's required by the code. Then I look at the foam and I look for cracks, delamination. I do a thump test if it's depending on the kind of foam and where it is. And
what's a thump test?
Thump test. If you thump on the foam with your fist and there's a void behind the foam, you can tell compared to foam that's well bonded. And I forget who I learned that from, but it wasn't my idea.
Well, I like it. I know with open cell, we do a push test.
Yeah. Well, you can do the thump test on open cell as well. And you can tell that there's a void in there. and you can do it with either open or closed cell.
Nice. So after the thump test, then what are you doing?
Well, if I'm inspecting, first of all, I don't know what the problem is yet, but I usually take my drywall knife and put a slit in every bay that I have access to. And by a slit, I mean, I cut the skin. My drywall knife makes a cut about 3/4 inch deep. And if the foam is unstable, meaning it has stresses inside it that make it want to shrink, if you slit it, that slit will open up. If you slit it and it doesn't open up, it's probably dimensionally stable. So sometimes if you slit it, it'll pop open and make a loud bang like a rifle going off. And, you know, that's a dimensional stability problem. And that's because the skin is denser than the core of the material and much stronger in tension than the rest of the cross section of the foam. So what I'm trying to do basically is, let's see how strong the stresses are in the core material by not letting the skins be what holds the whole thing together.
That makes sense. So then after you're doing a thump test and, you know, we'll call it an infield dimensional stability test. Slit test. Then what else are you doing? I mean, I guess it would probably be dependent on if it's a smell issue or if it's a shrinking issue. So if it's a shrinking issue, what would be left for you to do?
Well, I take samples with I have a core drill that's 3-inch in diameter, and I take samples and I will do a hot and cold 21-22, I think it is, test where we expose the material to temperatures above and below ambient, not beyond standard use in a building. So roof is 130, 140, 150 in that range. And, you know, in the winter, you might see -5, -10, whatever. But when you do that, when you put the samples in that kind of an environment, they will either stay the same size or they'll get bigger or smaller. And it's almost always smaller, whether it's hot or cold, foam always shrinks. So you want to, if you do that test, then that gives you more information about dimensional stability. And it's more specific and more reliable than the slit test, but it takes days, or you have to do it offsite.
Okay. And then when you're seeing something that's more of a smell issue, then what's your course of action?
I take a core sample of the foam and I take air samples in the locations where the odor or the people say there, you know, if I go in that room, I get a headache, that kind of anecdotal information. So I take air samples and I send the core to the lab and I send the air samples to the lab and get the results. Then I compare them. And if the results of the foam off gas test, what they do is they warm up the foam and they collect the vapors that come out of the foam. That's how you determine what chemistry is in the foam. And it may not necessarily be what's on the SDS sheet, but it compares the chemicals that come from the foam to the chemicals in the air. If there's a match there, then the source is most likely the spray foam. And once you have those matches, those compounds that match and are coming from the foam, then you look and see if the concentrations in the air are above or below what the EPA says is a acceptable exposure limit, or whether it's too high or whether it's safe.
Okay. So then you're taking samples, you're sending them off. You're obviously doing your dimensional stability test. Now, if you have a dimensional stability test and let's say someone's got 5 inches of closed cell, and you core sample that, you heat it up, put it in the freezer, pull it out, and it's got that, you know, we'll say hourglass shape to it. Okay.
Always.
What you say always. So what does it tell you then? What is that telling you when you see that hourglass on there?
Well, if you look at a density profile for any foam, spray foam that you process, It goes from high at the skins, both at the inside of the room and at the outside of the foam against the substrate, say, let's say a roof deck. Those two densities are the highest, and the core density is always the lowest. So the reason you get the hourglass shape is that the core material at the lower density is less stable than the skin densities, which are the top and bottom.
So
if you do a dense, go ahead.
I was just going to ask, because what you're telling me then, if I'm looking at a 1-inch pass, it's probably more stable than a 5-inch pass, because I just have a lot more core with a lot less density in the middle of it. Is that accurate?
Right. And yes, the old ASTM test method for density is only for foam that's 1.5 to 2 inch allowed in the pass, you know, the old way. And that test method says take the density for the average of the total thickness. So you only have a 1 to 2 inch cross section. But with the new HFOs and higher loft products, you know, then the core density matters, and you start to get, I used to do like, you know, every inch of cross section, I would check the density, but I found out that if you check the top, bottom, and middle third, you'll have a reasonable profile for the density of the product. And the middle density can be a whole pound per cubic foot lower than the top and bottom density. So it really is important in terms of how stable the cross section is, and that's why the foam shrinks.
So just to clarify again, because that's quite a thing. So if I'm spraying 2-pound foam, and let's say I'm spraying it 3 inches thick, there is a chance that the middle of that is closer to 1 pound than it is 2 pound. And then the two ends could be maybe even over 2.
Yes. And let me qualify that a little bit. If you spray a 2-pound foam on a roof deck that's got black tar paper on the outside in the summer, and the roof deck is 160, and you spray 6 inches of 2-pound, 2-inch foam on it, you will definitely have cracking and shrinkage. And if you take a cross section, you will find that hourglass shape even without heating or cooling it. As soon as you take it out of the foam that's on the roof, it will shrink right there in your hand.
Wow.
I mean, when you see multiple parameters at once, like substrate temperature, ambient temperature, and density and pass thickness, you do all those at once, you've got a big problem.
So we've talked about this at the Building Enclosure Committee, but I've never really talked to you in this setting about it. If I'm then spraying the newer foams and I spray, let's say, 3 inches and then 3 inches, really between those, in order to, let's say, promote stability, how long do I really need to be waiting? What is the temperature that I want that drop down to before I come back over it? Because I've seen some people publish, oh, you can, you know, the new stuff, you can go right over it and go right over it, and you can, you know, multiple passes and build up a, you know, carnival animal or something.
Yeah, I would say 140. Some manufacturers actually publish that, and it's less than that. But I think, you know, a conservative number is 140. But when I measure the temperature of test shots, I see as much as 300. So it's a, you know, it's important to let it cool down so that you're not adding heat to the next layer, which then overblows that middle third and makes the density less. You know, it's all about the density as to whether it's stable or not.
That makes perfect sense, actually. Now, when you go out on these types of projects, you know, you get a phone call, someone's unhappy. Is the manufacturer normally involved in those?
It depends on the homeowner and the installer and whether they think the manufacturer can help. The manufacturer is always protecting the installer because he's their client or their customer. And there's nothing wrong with that. The problem is it's sort of the wolf guarding the hen house, if you want to call it that. And the manufacturer's if they do any testing at all, and I've seen some that do, it's generally not the kind of testing you need. It certainly doesn't include air quality testing or dimensional stability. It's usually what's the density and does it smell? And odor testing doesn't tell you if it's off ratio necessarily, because some compounds don't have an odor. And, you know, it's, odor testing is somewhat subjective in terms of how you actually do it.
Well, I know the last one I went out on, Frank Lloyd Wright type house, you know, nice big house, very expensive area, and four of the ceiling cavities had perfect shrinkage going down one side of the cavity. Rest of the roof was fine, but these four were perfect shrinkage. And sure enough, the project was open to the weather and brand new wood, and the wood had enough moisture in it that the foam never really stood a chance of staying adhered on that side. It was just...
Now, is that the side that didn't show shrinkage or the side that did?
It completely delaminated from the side that had the wet wood.
Okay, and but was the foam of good quality or was it bad?
The foam was actually pretty good quality when we opened it up, but I did not heat it and freeze it. So we did look at the foam. The foam was of good quality. Everything else, and I didn't do a slit test, but everything else was, you know, stayed where it was supposed to. But what we noticed was it was almost 2 inches in a perfect line all the way down from end to end.
2 inches of crack?
Yeah, of gap where the foam had let go from that side. So I found that very unusual. But I guess my question would be, if you were to list your top four things for best practices to have things go right and never get on recalled to your job site, what would those four be?
Well, precondition the chemicals to the right temperature, check, meet all the parameters that the manufacturer sets for the substrate, ambient, and so forth. And remember that you want to check, I mean, for example, your case where you just talked about, you know, one side was good and one side wasn't. Was the one side in the sun and the other side not in the sun? Or, you know, you have to consider environmental conditions to include, you know, solar gain. And sometimes you have to work around the house from the, so you're always either trying to work on the warm side if it's a cold day, or working on the cool side if it's a hot day, et cetera. But that's not four, that's the first two. I would say make sure the substrate is, you know, dry enough. I don't think I've ever seen ambient conditions for relative humidity be a problem, but theoretically that's there. The substrate should not be above the upper limit or below it. And I think one of the causes of thermal shock, which means the foam shrinks because it gets cold too soon, is because when we use temporary heat in a building in a cold climate, you heat the inside of the space. Let's say you heat it up to 80 and the guys are in their t-shirt spraying when it's 20 degrees outside, all right? And the substrate is at 50. And that's cool. I mean, that's good. It's appropriate for a foam system that has, you know, an ambient lower temperature range of 50. However, when you're done spraying that R20, let's say, on the walls, now the ambient temperature of the substrate is the same as the outdoor ambient temperature. So now the outside ambient is 20. And the manufacturers don't tell you what the substrate temperature should be during the cure period. They only tell you while you're spraying it. So when I did cold work, in order to work all year round, when I did cold weather work, I would, number one, overheat the inside space. And number two, I would either put concrete curing blankets on the outside, or I would tent it and heat the tent on the outside so that the substrate stayed at the same minimum temperature as they required it during the install, or at least the cure period.
So a question on that, because a lot of them say, and I love your explanation. I never really thought about the fact that as soon as I insulate that, it's dropping back to 20 or dropping back to
zero. That's right. Or whatever, whatever it goes down to that night.
Yeah. So I could see where that would shock it. So what about, because a lot of people talk about a flash pass. If I do a flash pass and let that cure out, then I'm coming back on something that isn't going to quite be the exterior temperature. Do you find that effective, or is that really not going to quite get me there?
No, because you're going to then spray 4 more inches on the inside. So, you know, the temperature on that cross section is going to be a slope or a gradient across the wall. And it doesn't matter if that first inch is already cured or not. First of all, you'd have to wait 24 to 72 hours for it to cure. And most guys aren't going to wait that long after a flash pass. And theoretically, the flash pass has enough R value that the outside is now too cold also. Now, it may crack, and it may not be a problem because you're going to spray 4 more inches of foam over that, or 2.5 more inches or whatever over that. And you're going to fill in any cracks, and you're going to bond to the framing and so forth again anyway. But the bottom line is, I think the manufacturers, and I've asked manufacturers, never got an answer. They should weigh in on how long you have to maintain what temperature after the foam is processed. So, you know, once it's in place, do I need to keep that 50 degrees for the next 24 to 72 hours? You know, can I let it cool down overnight? If you look at the temperatures required for freezers and coolers, they have what's called a pull-down schedule. And if you follow the pull-down schedule for freezers and coolers, you can see that you can let the conditions get colder slowly and still have good foam that isn't affected. I would tend to, if you have a total lack of information about substrate conditions during the cure period, I would use a pull-down schedule as a guideline.
So when you've got bad foam, because you've shown up on quite a few projects where, you know, people thought they had to totally remove and replace it, and that is really expensive to do. What solutions do you generally have for remedy?
That's a complicated answer, but if the unreacted chemicals are running down the wall, I don't think there's any recourse but to remove and replace with an intermediate step of neutralization, cleaning and neutralization, so the substrate is clean and safe. Because you don't want to put good foam over a substrate that's then going to off gas anyway. But if the foam is generally of good quality, like you said, that foam in the roof that delaminated would be considered to be effective as insulation, it just wasn't connected anymore, you can then remediate that foam. Number one, you relieve the stress in the foam, because if it's shrinking, it's got pull force within the foam. It's trying to contract. So you have to relieve that stress so it doesn't crack later. I've seen lots of jobs where they went back with a can gun or the big gun and filled in the cracks. And then the next day, they had new cracks beside the old ones or in the middle, away from where they patched, and it's opened up again. So you have to relieve the stress in the core of the material before you repair it so that it doesn't happen again. And then if the foam is of good quality, and I think this is where you're going, then you can remediate it in the sense that you make it effective as a building enclosure material again, as insulation and air barrier that's stable. Then you can manage even off-gassing with isolation and ventilation. And that's a much lower cost than remove and replace, because removal is a nightmare. I've seen lots of it. You know, it's not easy. You never get it all. And you can't get the residue out of the substrate if the material was off ratio enough that it can soak into the materials. So I don't know if I covered your question, but.
Well, you know, say one of our contractors gets a call and someone put in product that really did not meet that product standard. They show up and let's say it seems like there's an odor. at that point, how would you address the remediation? You know, a lot of them, you know, they're like, well, the best advice is just walk away. Well, they're going to need somebody to take care of their project. So at that point, what would your course of action be to go in there? You know, would you, if it smells, would you start a remove and replace?
No, I would determine if it's possible to salvage the foam first, because it's always going to be less expensive to make that foam work as part of the building closure than it will be to remove and remove it and then put it back. And unfortunately, I've seen lots of situations where when they put it back, that foam is bad also. But, you know, you have to test to see if the foam, you know, the foam may have an odor, but it may not be unsafe. And the foam may not have an odor and it might not be safe. So, you know, you have different symptoms that you're dealing with, and you want to determine if it's so bad that you don't think you can isolate it, whether so that you don't try to save it. But usually if it's hard to tell what the ratio is or was, but usually if the ratio is within, I would say within 20% of what it should have been, you'll probably have foam, and I'm talking closed cell, that is stable enough. Well, you can, that can be stabilized and can still perform as R value for the building. Okay. So if you relieve the stress and seal the cracks after you relieve the stress, and you're going to make more cracks when you relieve the stresses. So, and you reseal it, that makes the material stable and you're not going to have more cracking. So that handles the building enclosure issues. And then you have to isolate that foam from the occupied space and ventilate in a way that you would protect the occupied space from the off-gassing. So a good analogy would be if you've got soil gas under your slab in your house and it's radon that you're having, you don't tear out the earth. You depressurize that in that space under the slab in the gravel and exhaust it to the outdoors. You don't throw away the ground and the slab. So we're going to use that analogy as a way of remediating the spray foam.
So you're almost setting up a fan for a very long period to take air out of that space?
A radon fan that will make the pressure in, are we going to talk about an attic or are we going to talk about a finished house?
Yeah, well, yeah, if it's a finished house, I don't know how you would in turn get rid of all of that smell. Maybe you know, add an inch over everything. I don't even know if that would work, or if you, same thing with an attic.
I've done 10 projects that were already finished that had odors coming out of the foam, and we depressurized that interstitial space between the back of the drywall and the face of the foam and exhausted that to the outside with a radon fan. And then tested the air and it was perfectly safe. And that cost 1/10 of what it would cost to remove the foam.
So how would you get to the interstitial space behind the drywall? Would I drill a hole in the top plate and put a little tube in there and connect it all to a fan?
Well, it's going to be hard to explain without drawings, especially since I'm an architect and I think of things in pictures, but I can show you slides with sketches, but basically, if it's a cathedral slope, we take the top foot of drywall off on both sides, put a mini attic, you know, drop ceiling down a foot and a half. That makes a duct that goes the length of the ridge. And all of those roof bays are connected to that space at the ridge. And you're going to depressurize that and suck the air up the slopes into that space. And then you blow it outdoors to a safe location.
Don't blow it
into the play yard.
That is creative.
And I've done that in basements. I've done that in finished homes. And I can show you details of how we connect the walls to the roof so you have just that one fan location in a house. And I did that on a house, just to give you a little bit of a smile, did that on a house that had been, they had sprayed it wrong. They moved everybody out. They gutted the house. They resprayed it. And then they refinished it, and then they moved back in and found out the second application was bad. So we did that. This, the method I'm talking about, the radon approach, the second time. And the first time it cost $150,000, and the second time it cost $14,000.
That's so a big price difference.
We did two different methods on the same house, same contractor, same bad foam, unfortunately, for the owners. But and they didn't have to move out during the second application.
Wow. So we haven't really talked about equipment yet. So let's just say if my maintenance plan on my equipment is just to fix things as soon as I know they're broken, is that soon enough, or do I need a tighter maintenance schedule than that? What was your practice?
Well, I think that's likely to be, you know, what happens, that you, that that's the way people will operate. But I will tell you that when it breaks isn't soon enough, because you don't know how much bad foam you've installed in somebody's house that way. So my recommendation for the last 20 years has been that you need flow monitoring equipment that tells you what your ratio is, which, you know, most industry standard equipment doesn't have that capability. And it should have fault protection that if you're off ratio, it shuts down your operation.
How easy is that? How easy is that for me to add to standard, you know, traditional equipment?
Well, first of all, the industry standard manufacturer makes machines that have that from the beginning, because every manufacturer of molded parts has that. And I have been to projects where they have an E50 or something, you know, that has flow monitoring and has fault protection. And you can buy an aftermarket flow setup that will shut you down. You know, the industry standard manufacturer makes those now and offers them, because I've been blaming them for foam failures for a long time. But the, you know, they make that equipment, it's available, and it might cost, let's say it cost you $15,000 or even $20,000. That's nothing compared to the cost of one failure. And you can have one failure. If you have two drums in your rig and you run out of one, and you know that can happen to everybody. Everybody's had that happen, right? So for a while you spray one chemical. If you don't clean that unreacted one side out of the wall or roof bay before you spray again, it's going to come back to haunt you, because that one area could shrink, that one area could smell, and then the owner will think the whole job is bad. And I've seen that happen many times. So you need to remediate even a short period off ratio event like that every time it happens, and clean it and remove the, you know, the one side, or react it with the other side. That's another way to neutralize it. But you need to address being off ratio immediately. And if you have ratio monitoring equipment, I've seen projects where the ratio monitor, the installer didn't want to fix the problem that was causing it to shut down. So they just overrode the set point for when it shuts down and made it so outrageously high that it didn't help. So they were off ratio, because they had the machine, they tricked the machine into thinking that, you know, off by 50% was okay.
When someone is having an issue, you know, ran out of chemical, one side clogged up, that part that you just sprayed out is what needs to be removed. You said you've been on many projects where that one part was what caused the overall problem.
No, only it caused the problem in that one location, but the owner sees that spot or smells, or it makes a smell in the room, and maybe it's 4 square feet out of 4,000 square feet, and they think the whole job is bad, because you can't tell to look at the foam where the, if that is everywhere or just in that one spot.
I could see where that could happen very easily. Now, I know our industry also has often taught sprayers to, you know, quote, read the foam. That's one of the main training techniques is you read the foam and stop as soon as you see a change in the reaction, you know, processing color, structure of the foam. You know, how well do you think that works for people? I know you want them to go to flow meters, but, you know, is reading the foam really helping as much as we've been led to believe?
If that was effective, I would have no work.
There you go. Well, that's
every failure could have been read before it was a problem. I mean, I can show you pictures of projects where they sprayed a whole house with one chemical and it was B-side. So it foamed up. And when the foam collapsed because it was just B-side, it's all running down the walls. I mean, the light fixtures downstairs were full of raw chemicals because it ran down into the ceiling and then down into the light fixtures. So, you know, and it doesn't take a big area to cause a question as to whether the quality is good everywhere or not. And you know, every failure, every off ratio failure is, you know, I did a house in Connecticut. The contractor did it twice and it failed both times, had to be removed and replaced after the second time. So, you know, you can't tell, first of all, when you remove the first time that it's off, unless you remediate the substrate, you can still have off-gassing from the original bad foam through a subsequent good foam. So you really need to remediate any off-ratio material, but you know, that guy insisted that he'd been spraying for 20 years and he could tell if it was bad when it happened. And, you know, that was, they had to gut the whole house. So it's, you know, it's unfortunate, but you can see, you might see 30% off ratio, but I don't know if you can see 12% off ratio. And I don't know if you could, I mean, when we talked, you said the foam looked pretty good, but what percent off ratio was it in that roof that had a 2-inch crack all the way down?
We didn't test it, so we wouldn't know.
You didn't test it. And it's very difficult to have testing done to determine what the ratio of that material was. So, and expensive, and it's after the fact. It's too late.
So
you want to know that as you do it, not after the fact.
So you can have flow meters, but do you find that some equipment's better than others? I mean, we've got some fairly inexpensive equipment that comes in from out of the country. We've got some, you know, it's kind of all across the map now. It's almost like Amazon or eBay is selling some, you know, some very, I don't know, it almost looks like hobby equipment. But do you find that equipment makes a difference as well?
I don't see very many installers using anything but industry standard equipment. I mean, I don't know if you want to talk about trade names in this session or not, but the you know, I could talk to you about different brands and what I see, but it's, you know, I don't know if that's appropriate.
No, I'm not trying to get anyone in trouble. I just know we've seen where there's some real, you know, screaming deals, like you can get a whole rig for $5,000 and not $5,000, but, you know, literally get a trailer for $20,000 and try and make that work. And I know they've had trouble getting their chemical to work, but I didn't know if you yourself had seen where equipment made a big difference in the end product of what you're getting.
Well, if the equipment includes ratio monitoring and the set points are kept not necessarily at the default, but at a ratio that is approved by the chemical manufacturer. So, you know, ask your supplier, how far off ratio can I be and still make good foam? You know, that tolerance is critical to how you set up any ratio monitoring system that has fault protection. You need to tell that machine, how far off can I be before you shut me down? So that's, you know, that's a piece of that puzzle. And if that equipment comes and doesn't have a way to adjust that and so forth, I would say I'd stay away from it. I like the industry standard equipment if possible.
As do I. It's so, you know, we've talked about, obviously, your fixes aren't a one size fits all. Your inspections aren't a one size fits all. At this point, with some of the customers you've had in the past and the ones you're getting now, are you getting calls to manage new spray foam projects?
Once in a while. Usually it's somebody who says, I've heard disaster stories and I don't want that to happen at my house. And I oversee new installations that way. It adds to the cost. So a lot of people don't do it. And, you know, it's usually high-end clients. But if you offer that, if you were an installer and you offered that as an option, I wouldn't be surprised if you couldn't upsell installations that way. Most people are going to look for the lowest possible price, so that won't include commissioning. But, you know, your higher-end clients may like that. And if your higher-end clients are doing an installation that was designed by an architect or a building science guy or whatever, and they recommend commissioning, then that's likely to happen. And as an installer, you should welcome that because it protects you and the client. But I often see installers who won't bid jobs if there's commissioning.
Yeah, I'm not surprising. Sure. Yeah, I'm not sure I understand why someone wouldn't want commissioning. You know, it, like you said, it's spreading the liability at the very least. And if we're talking a museum or airport.
How about a house where they said, I won't bid that because if I give documentation to the homeowner, it increases my liability. Believe it or not, that's what they said. Because I require submittals if I'm commissioning a project, I make them give me an SDS and a TDS and all the different product documentation. And then I ask them for anything that's missing and they get that from the manufacturer, which is appropriate. But then I know that they have all the data they need to properly do the work. And I have all the data that I need to verify that they're doing all the work per the manufacturer's requirements. So I think it's a win-win. In every job I do, one of the things that's part of my shtick, so to speak, is I give the installer an infrared thermometer. Because most installers, even high-end installers, the guys in the truck don't even have a thermometer. I mean, I calibrate the machines and so forth to make sure they're on ratio. I have them do a high stall test and so forth, but they can't check the temperature of the chemicals. And I use a probe thermometer that's the depth of a 55-gallon drum to measure the chemicals at the bottom where the transfer pumps pick up the chemicals to see what the chemical temperatures are, not on the outside of the drum. And I will tell you that you can have a 25 degree difference between those two locations. But, you know, the key is they need to measure the ambient, the substrate, you know, the temperature of their test shots and so forth. And they don't have the equipment to do that. So, you know, I have that, but I give them a thermometer on every job.
Well, that's a surprising number that I could have a 25 degree temperature difference between, you know, the chemical at the bottom and what I find at the top or the drum temperature itself. That's substantial. Well, and that's
what do
where
you
I'm
do pulling. When you get to, what's the first thing they do when they get to the job? They open all the doors on the truck, right?
Yep.
And turn on the machine. Well, the drum that's right next to the door is suddenly, if it's 20 degrees outside, and even if the rig is 70 inside, suddenly that side of the drum is now cold. And if they measure at the top above the liquid level, they're measuring the nitrogen or the air temperature in the drum, not the chemical temperature.
Yeah, that's true.
You know, and they say, well, there's a thermometer right here on the side of the proportioner where the liquid comes in. And I say, well, you can't read that until you have flow, you know, because that doesn't tell you what the incoming chemical temperature is until you're reading flow. You need to know what the temperature in the container is before you start processing it, because the first thing that the chemicals come to is the piston pumps, which is what you want. That's where you want the ratio to be 1-to-1 by volume at 70 degrees.
Well, that is a lot of advice. Thank you for joining us today. The main goal is making good foam every time, having a great reputation for your company. If you come up against a project where someone's had something go south and you want to make sure that you can go in and remediate that job, I would tell you to reach out to Henri, find out more about the remediation process and what you can and cannot do going forward. But as we said, the main goal is making good product first time out when you go to the job. And the number one advice out of this to do that was preconditioning your chemicals and having them at the right temperature before you ever start the project. So have that infrared thermometer, have something to check your drum temperatures, and we hope that you guys are out there making a difference every day. There's nothing like what you guys do. You all make the buildings better. We know that. The only ones listening to this are the good guys. So we thank you for listening, for making it this far, and for the fact that you care. If you've got questions on spray foam rigs, styrofoam, fiberglass, you know, dowel boards, you name it. If it's on any of the products we sell, reach out to your local branch, reach out to anyone at IDI, where we look forward to earning your business every day.